What to do about Russia? Today we'll hear that even European nations can't agree. Also today, caught up in the fighting at a prison in northeastern Syria, children as young as 12, brought to Syria by their parents to join the Islamic State insurgency, now unable to return home.
These children never should have been detained in this prison in the first place. Shame on their home countries for leaving them, for abandoning them.
I'm Marco Werman, and call it Australia Day or call it Invasion Day, we look at how the meaning of January 26 was changed forever by an act of defiance 50 years ago.
It captured the imagination of Australians. I mean, Australians back then used to love to see somebody powerless to make the people in power look foolish.
Plus, Mr. Ortiz goes to Cooperstown. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us today. In northeastern Syria, a coordinated attack at a prison appears to be under control. Islamic State militants were trying to free hundreds of prisoners. For several days, they fought against the Syrian Democratic Forces that control that part of the country. The violence in and around the prison was so intense that American and British forces were called in to help. This facility is one of many in northeastern Syria holding thousands of suspected ISIS members. Among them are many young children. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari with the latest.
After 6 days of intense fighting outside of Al-Sinaa prison in northeastern Syria, a moment of joy today. Soldiers from the U.S.-supported Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, paraded through the streets of Al-Hasaka city. Arms raised in the air, they waved their rifles in celebration. This moment seemed so far off just a few hours before. It all began last Thursday. About 200 Islamic State fighters set off two car bombs near the prison. In the chaos that followed, hundreds of detainees escaped into the city. The ones who stayed inside the prison took hostages and then clashed with SDF troops.
It's very hard here. I'm very scared.
This is a voice message from a 17-year-old boy caught up in the fighting inside the prison. He identifies himself as Australian and describes the scene.
My friends got killed here. I'm very scared. I'm by myself. There's a lot of people dead, a lot of people injured. People are screaming next to me. People are scared.
This audio was provided by Lera Taylor. She is with Human Rights Watch.
He is begging for help. He says he's been shot in the head.
Taylor says she's in touch with someone who is close to this boy's family in Australia. They are worried about his safety and don't want to make his name public. SDF officials have not released the exact number of children in Al-Sinaa prison. The United Nations says it's about 700. Some of these kids are suspected ISIS members. The terrorist group used children in its propaganda videos and trained some of them to fight. But Lera Taylor says not all of these children participated in ISIS atrocities. They were either taken to Syria by their parents or were born there.
ISIS members had families. And these families had many children.
When the so-called caliphate fell in 2019, the U.S.-led coalition and Syrian Democratic Forces rounded up ISIS suspects and put them in camps. That's where they have remained ever since. Adolescent boys are separated from their mothers and transferred to different locations, including Al-Sinaa prison. Lera Taylor says this practice is against international law.
None of these boys has been brought before a judge. None of these boys has been charged with any crime.
The Kurdish authorities, who control northeastern Syria, have not released a list of detainees' nationalities. This is a highly political issue. Often, the prisoners' home countries don't want to take them back. In some cases, they have been stripped of their citizenship.
These children never should have been detained in this prison in the first place. Shame on their home countries for leaving them, for abandoning them.
Besides the Australian boy, Taylor has connected with at least one American man and one Canadian man in detention. Nicholas Harris with the New Lines Institute in Washington sees a common thread among those minors who participated in ISIS fighting.
They have nowhere else to go. Either their tribe, clan, or family hasn't taken them back yet, or alternatively, they are so committed ISIS's ideology that there's a process of de-radicalization that has to occur.
But so far that hasn't happened, he says. And these children, along with their family members, are stuck in camps or prisons in Syria's northeast.
Most of these countries are worried that you have highly radicalized young men who, if they go back to their countries of origin, could in fact become part of terrorist cells and could cause problems and conduct attacks and support ISIS in their countries of origin.
On Tuesday, Australia's foreign minister responded to questions from reporters about the 17-year-old caught up in the fighting in Al-Sana'a prison. Maryse Payne said she was seeking advice about the matter and that, quote, Australia does not have diplomatic representation in Syria. This morning, videos posted by Kurdish reporters on Twitter showed ISIS members lined up outside the prison. The SDF says it has retaken full control of the prison. Nicholas Harris of New Lines Institute summed up the past 6 days like this.
Frankenstein's monster of prison break, special forces direct action combat, and a highly televised high-stake game of hostage.
The attack on the prison, he says, shows that ISIS is not done and that the international community needs to take concrete steps to deal with hundreds of detainees still being held in northeastern Syria. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
A boat capsized between the Bahamas and Florida over the weekend. Dozens of people who were on board are now missing. The U.S. Coast Guard was able to rescue one person, but it's feared that 38 others will not be found. Coast Guard spokesperson Joanne Burdian says they believe no one was wearing a life jacket.
We do suspect that this is a case of human smuggling. This event occurred in a normal route for human smuggling from the Bahamas into the southeast U.S.
The Florida Straits have a long history as a treacherous migration route for people leaving Latin America and the Caribbean hoping to make it to the United States. Adriana Gomez-Licon is a Hispanic affairs reporter for the Associated Press based in Miami. What is the latest, Adriana, that we know about the people who were on the boat that capsized?
We know there is a survivor and he was being treated and is in stable condition, but we have not been able to figure out the nationalities of the people who were in the boat.
I know this is like hardly the first migrant boat to capsize off the coast of Florida. Can you briefly give us kind of the history of people who migrated over the years across the Florida Straits?
Absolutely, yes. So migrants from around the world really have long used the Bahamas as a stepping stone to reach the U.S. This is typically a season for them. It's winter and the conditions seem better to make these journeys. They take advantage of breaks in the water, but they are still at risk of having this incident happen because their boats are small, overloaded, and there's still sometimes severe weather conditions that unfortunately make these accidents happen.
So can you give us a sense of just how treacherous this journey across the Florida Straits is?
It really all depends on what boats are used. From what we hear from the Coast Guard, first of all, they're not wearing life jackets. Second of all, many of these pilots don't have the experience to be leading these journeys across the Florida Straits. So it's a very dangerous journey. The Coast Guard has tried for years to deter people from doing that, and they have continued to happen.
There's also been a long history of how the U.S. has responded to people trying to migrate by sea from the Caribbean, correct? Can you kind of give us a sense of that?
Yes, there have been changes in the policies, and this is specifically related to Cuban migrants. They used to, once they set foot in the U.S., be able to adjust their status and get residency. That is no longer the case. If they are found, if they are seized by Border Patrol or Coast Guard, they are repatriated.
Now, the U.S. Coast Guard believes these migrants were coming from the Bahamas. If that is the case, help us understand how the Bahamas fit in terms of common migration routes from Latin America and the Caribbean.
Yes, so there's tons of islands in the Bahamas where migrants coming from Haiti and from southern Cuba have to go through to make these journeys. For instance, last Friday, the Royal Bahamas Defense Force talked about the rescue of 31 migrants who were in an overcrowded boat that capsized. Similar incident. In that case, they were rescued.
So I just want to underline again what you said earlier, Adriana. We still don't know about the nationalities of the people on this boat that capsized. I do think of the turmoil that Haiti has been going through in the past year especially, though. Has migration by boat to the U.S. been increasing recently, and are U.S. authorities expecting more boats heading for Florida?
So we are looking at the numbers of Haitians and Cubans that have been, I should say, interdicted by the Coast Guard, and they are on pace to surpass last year's numbers. We also, I'm sure you remember the situation at the southern border last September, when we saw thousands of Haitians being held in these temporary staging area under the international bridge between Mexico and the U.S. Right. So there's that history of Haitian migrants seeking refuge and seeking to come to the U.S.
Adriana Gomez-Licon is a Hispanic affairs reporter for the Associated Press, reporting today out of Miami Beach. Adriana, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Red Sox slugger David Ortiz got the call of his life last night.
I'm calling you from Cooperstown, New York, to let you know that the baseball writers have elected you to the National Baseball Hall.
Yes!
The man we all know as Big Poppy is headed for the Baseball Hall of Fame. Ortiz was in his home country, the Dominican Republic, when he got the call. Word of his induction hit local news there fast.
Esta noche habrá una gran fiesta en República Dominicana.
One big party across the country. Ortiz is a fourth Dominican-born player to be elected to the Hall of Fame and joins former Boston Red Sox teammate Pedro Martinez, who congratulated Ortiz on Twitter.
I feel so proud to have been your teammate, to have been your brother, to have been someone there for you. God bless you. Enjoy your day. The entire world is happy, and I love you, boy. Yeah.
Ortiz made his name hitting some seriously clutch home runs at Fenway Park here in Boston.
Ortiz in the deep right field. Back is Sheffield. We'll see you later tonight.
Yankee fans will remember that one forever. 2004, Game 4 of the American League Championship Series, when Ortiz started the greatest comeback in baseball history. When the chips were on the line, fan-favorite Ortiz always pulled through, on and off the field. After the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013, it's not hyperbole to say Ortiz helped unify the city.
This jersey that we wear today, it doesn't say Red Sox. It say Boston.
He added, "This is our city," with an expletive thrown in for good measure. As much as Ortiz is connected to Boston, last night he said that this achievement belongs to his home country in the Caribbean. Dominicans around the world are just as thrilled.
El galardón otorgado a David Ortiz.
Ramon Antonio Cruz Ventura is a consul general of the Dominican Republic in Boston. He says his country is proud of Ortiz.
Y cuando suceden este tipo de eventos con uno de los nuestros, siempre es una fiesta nacional.
And he said, when this kind of thing happens to someone from the Dominican Republic, it's always a national party. You're with the world.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Now 2 years into this pandemic, here is the understatement of the year. We are all ready to move on. We've also heard, don't get complacent. That is the big message this week from global health leaders as the Omicron variant continues to spread across the globe. Still, as the world's Ilana Gordon reports, living with this virus could become a lot more manageable in the months to come if certain steps are taken.
Omicron is tearing through communities around the world, from Johannesburg to Boston.
It is obviously a truly remarkable virus in terms of its capacity for rapid spread, and it looks like it is intrinsically more transmissible than Delta.
For William Hanitch, an epidemiologist at Harvard, he predicts it may be harder to find a person or place that won't be touched by this variant in some way, shape, or form in the coming months.
By the late spring, almost everybody will have either been infected, vaccinated, or both.
But experts say that doesn't mean it's time to stop fighting the spread. Quite the opposite. The World Health Organization's director, Tedros Ghebreyesus, warned about this earlier this week.
Learning to live with COVID cannot mean that we give this virus a free ride. It cannot mean that we accept almost 50,000 deaths a week from a preventable and treatable disease.
Ghebreyesus said there are different scenarios on how the pandemic could play out and how this emergency phase could end. Nearly 6 million people have died so far. He says the world has got to change the conditions that are driving its unfettered spread.
It's dangerous to assume that Omicron will be the last variant or that we are in the end game. On the contrary, globally, the conditions are ideal for more variants to emerge.
Reducing this threat means stepping up vaccination rates to at least 70% of countries' populations in the coming months. Right now, there's a long way to go. More than 80 countries have not even reached 40%. It also means improved monitoring of variants and increased access to basic healthcare and treatments for COVID. Cecilia Tamari is a global health professor at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. She says Omicron's impact is not inevitable.
The critical issue here in the United States, we are starting to have this discourse where we're taking this for granted, that this is the only possibility, and that's just not true.
She worries that a certain kind of complacency or resignation is setting in.
I mean, you know, if you don't even bother to slow it down, you know, you will end up with overwhelmed healthcare systems.
And beyond exhausted health workers. She says non-vaccine strategies can still make a big difference, especially in surges. Countries like South Korea, which have far fewer cases and deaths, have demonstrated the power of masking, improved indoor ventilation, testing. Harvard's Bill Hannage says new data suggests Omicron may be less devastating in places like the UK than it could have been, thanks to previous immunity, vaccinations, and boosters. That's a good thing, but optimism is relative when so many deaths and long-term complications can be prevented.
Just remember, a pandemic is a marathon, not a sprint. I do think that we're closer to the finish line now than we were, but before anybody runs away from this full of confidence and, you know, looking forward to the sunlit uplands which lie the other side of the Omicron peak, I want to bear in mind Omicron leapt into our lives a few months ago and transformed what we were expecting.
Which is why moving into year three of this pandemic, Hannage says it's not totally clear what this next leg of the race will bring. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
In Greece, it has been called a conspiracy of silence, the unwillingness to discuss sexual assault and gender-based violence. Slowly, though, reticence is giving way to outrage. I want to caution that this next segment may not be appropriate for younger listeners. We're talking about the trial of a sailing coach now underway in Athens. The coach faces charges of raping a young athlete in 2010. The case came to light after a Greek Olympic gold medal winner in sailing spoke out about the abuse she endured after trials for the 2000 Olympics. Athens-based attorney Ioanna Stentoumi has been following the trial. She specializes in child protection and gender-based violence. Ioanna, the alleged victim in this trial, is testifying behind closed doors. She was 11 at the time of the alleged assault. Mm-hmm. What does she say happened to her?
The girl explains that the perpetrator, who was approximately 30 years old, he raped her several times from the age of 11 until the age of 13 when she confronted him and talked to her parents about the rapes. And they went to the police. They didn't file an official complaint. They were afraid that this would hurt her even more psychologically, so they just moved to another place.
And now this case is in court. The sailing coach, Triantafylos Apostolou, did not deny the relationship. He has even commented that he did not feel like a rapist. What else has he said to try and defend himself?
So what the perpetrator in this case said, it's not something strange, unfortunately. He said that I was in love with her. It was a consensual relationship and I was going to marry her. And it's something that many perpetrators have used. It's embarrassing to say, but it's true, unfortunately, that in the Greek penal law until 2018, there was an article that says that if the victim is underage, but after the harassment or the rape, even the rape, we have a marriage, then it's not a criminal act.
This current trial seems to have opened the floodgates for allegations of sexual assault all over Greece. Have you noticed that in your own legal practice?
Yes, yes, of course. And not only women, actually. Also men and young boys. It was also a movement in the university, actually in the University of Thessaloniki. Many young students, they filed charges against one professor that for years was harassing sexually his students. And after that, we see many women start talking.
So, Ioana, you said you've been seeing this momentum growing yourself for the Me Too movement in Greece. But ultimately, what needs to change in the Greek legal system if it's going to hold perpetrators of sexual assault to account? I mean, it sounds like culture needs to change at the same time.
Yes. One thing is the legal system. The other thing is the culture. From the beginning, from the school, the last years we started having gender studies in the universities only. We don't learn anything about gender, sex, and our body and consent during school, actually.
I mean, there is this trial underway in Athens, so I'm wondering what it symbolizes for you, just in terms of overall change in how sexual abuse is viewed for most Greeks.
We actually are very anxious about what is going to happen with that case, but we are also very optimistic, okay, and I'm very optimistic. This case now, it will create something different in the justice system, actually. We're very anxious to see how this court is going to analyze consent, because we are behind the evolution in case law. It's very important, yes.
Attorney Ioana Stentoumi specializes in child protection and gender-based violence, speaking with us from Athens to talk about the trial of a sailing coach and how it's increasing momentum for the Me Too movement in Greece. Ioana, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you for calling me.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Cash or mobile money transfers. In Ghana, reliance on mobile money apps has made them a target for the government. A proposed tax on mobile phone transactions is not going over so well.
Things are getting tougher and tougher every day. To increase that is too much. So we are pleading with the government. If they can do something about it, it will be very nice, because it's too much.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. U.S. and NATO officials gave a written note to Moscow today. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the letter, quote, sets out a serious diplomatic path forward should Russia choose it. Blinken is scheduled to speak with his Russian counterpart to discuss next steps within a few days. Meanwhile, in Paris today, French diplomats hosted talks with their counterparts from Germany, Russia, and Ukraine. The meeting was an attempt to calm tensions over Moscow's massive military buildup along its border with Ukraine. The foreign ministers from France and Germany are expected to travel to Kiev in a few days to show their solidarity with Ukraine. But as our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, behind the scenes, European leaders are not all that united.
The buildup of Russian troops on Ukraine's borders is the biggest crisis in Europe right now. But getting consensus among the bloc's political leaders on just what to do about it is proving tricky. Speaking in Parliament, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the UK, the EU and the US stand together.
We agreed that we would respond in unison to any Russian attack on Ukraine. In unison, by imposing coordinated and severe economic sanctions, heavier than anything we have done before against Russia.
But Johnson also acknowledged that not everyone is on board. Some European countries, in particular Germany, rely heavily on Russian gas exports. David Clark says the German response to the crisis has been unhelpful. He's a former advisor to the British Foreign Office.
It has sent mixed messages on the question of economic sanctions against Russia. And of course, there is this vexed question of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which Germany and Russia have been building together in order to increase gas supply from Russia into Europe through Germany. And Germany is under a lot of pressure to pull the plug on the project and has refused to do so.
The Germans are refusing to give weapons to Ukraine. Denmark, on the other hand, is sending fighter jets to Lithuania, a NATO member. And France says it's willing to deploy troops to Romania. Defence analyst Malcolm Chalmers says Germany's reluctance isn't just about gas supplies.
Germany actually has been very consistent for decades, since the 1950s, in its reluctance to use military force. The German people, the German political class, learned from the experience of two disastrous wars which they initiated that war wasn't an acceptable instrument of policy.
Germany is the largest economy in Europe, and Chalmers says not having the German Chancellor take the lead in a crisis like this is a problem.
There is no clear leading state in the EU. The only potential leader, Germany, has got such a special reluctance to contemplate the use of force that it can't be a credible leader in this regard. It's not a good crisis for the European Union, because I think it has been sidelined and will continue to be sidelined as long as it remains disunited.
Some experts say Russia will take full advantage of the political divisions in Europe. Scott Lucas is Emeritus Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham.
Putin's gamble is, look, while you're focusing on the military forces, he's going to continue to try to use the prospect of an invasion and the wider issues, such as hybrid warfare, to try to put a wedge between the US and Europe, to put a wedge between different European states, to put a wedge between the political systems and NATO.
That divide is apparent with Britain. It's still a member of NATO, of course, but because of Brexit, David Clark says, the UK is a bit of an outsider at the moment.
The UK at the moment doesn't really have a seat at any of the diplomatic tables for talking about these issues that count.
Boris Johnson's tough stance on Russia also comes at a difficult time for the Prime Minister. He's in political hot water after reports of parties being held at 10 Downing Street during Britain's lockdown. Yesterday, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick said London police are now looking into the matter.
I can confirm that the Met is now investigating a number of events that took place at Downing Street and Whitehall in the last 2 years in relation to potential breaches of COVID-19 regulations.
There's been some speculation that Johnson is just trying to distract from his own domestic troubles. Political analyst Scott Lucas says that's not fair.
I think this is the UK system functioning despite Johnson, despite the party gate, despite all the scandals. Regarding the possibility of a direct military cross-border operation, this is the way that partnership should be working.
Still, Johnson has a lot on his plate, and he's not alone. Germany's new Chancellor Olaf Scholz is only a few weeks into the job, and Emmanuel Macron has a presidential election coming up. Getting a unified response from the European leaders right now might be a tall order. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Today marks a national holiday in Australia, a fraught holiday. It's known as Australia Day, observing the arrival of the first British settlers in 1788. Some see January 26 as the beginnings of modern Australia. Others see it as the start of the systematic dispossession of Australia's indigenous people. Also on this day, 50 years ago, 1972, one of the most famous episodes of indigenous activism took place. Aboriginal activists set up a tent across from Australia's House of Parliament in the capital, Canberra, with a sign that read, Aboriginal Embassy. Gary Foley is an Aboriginal Gumbanjer who was a big part of that act of protest. Today, he's a university professor and still active in fighting for Aboriginal rights. He joins us from Melbourne. Gary Foley, take us back, if you would, to 1972 and what the thinking was by creating this symbolic Aboriginal Embassy.
Well, it was a protest that came about almost by accident. Throughout 1971, there'd been intense Aboriginal political activism in the form of demonstrations for land rights to such an extent that the Australian Prime Minister of the day decided that he needed to make a statement on land rights. The only problem for him was that he chose to make that statement on the most sensitive political day of the year for Aboriginal people, the 26th of January, a day that we call Invasion Day. But worse still, his statement said that he would never grant Aboriginal land rights. So Aboriginal political collective in Sydney dispatched four men to set up a protest on the lawns of Parliament House in Canberra, the capital city of Australia. The expectation was they'd have a protest, get a photo in the paper, be arrested and bail them out the next day. But remarkably, when the police arrived to arrest them, it was discovered that there was, in fact, no law preventing people from camping on the lawns of Parliament House, which enabled us to maintain a protest presence on Parliament House for the next 6 months, which became history.
Do you see the Aboriginal embassy protests as kind of a before and after moment in terms of making Australia's Indigenous people seen?
I think that the Aboriginal embassy protest put the Australian political movement on the map. I mean, for the first time, the rest of the world began to hear that there was a major issue between the Indigenous people of Australia and the Australian government, and it had to do with recognising us, you know. Australia had a system of apartheid that predated South Africa and existed right up until 1967. So Aboriginal people had been comprehensively oppressed and kept out of sight and out of mind for the greater part of the 20th century, right up until the Aboriginal embassy.
So it attracted several thousand people in 1972, the protest, the Aboriginal embassy. It went on for months and years, really. I mean, a form of the protest is still going and is seen as the longest continuous protest in the world. Why do you think it succeeded so well in drawing attention to Indigenous issues in Australia?
Because it was so visible. It's in the heart of the capital city, across the road from what was then the Parliament House of Australia. Also, it captured the imagination of Australians. I mean, Australians back then used to love to see somebody powerless to make the people of power look foolish. The Aboriginal embassy did that. A lot of Australians responded to that and supported us. And the reason the government 6 months later felt the need to introduce a new law in order to get rid of it was because it had become so effective, educating the Australian people about their own dark history. Australia has a hidden racist past that it has difficulty still to this day coming to terms with, just like America.
Well, 50 years on, Gary, you're still an activist. I'm wondering what has changed and what has not changed for Indigenous people in Australia.
We still do not have land rights. We still do not have any meaningful political and economic independence. We remain, you know, suffering the ongoing effects of settler colonialism in our country, just as our Native American brothers and sisters continue to a certain extent to suffer the same.
Australia, I wanted to ask you about this, has two flags. One of them is called the Aboriginal flag. It was designed by an Indigenous artist and became Australia's other official flag in 1995. Can you describe it?
It consists of three colours, red, black and yellow. The black was originally intended to represent the people. The red, which was originally a red ochre colour, was supposed to represent the land. The line where the black and the red meet was supposed to be symbolic of the close relationship between the people and the land. And overlooking and protecting both the people and the land is the sun, the giver of life. The flag was created in 1971. I was actually there when it was created. A man called Harold Thomas, who's an Aboriginal artist from South Australia, designed the flag. And within 6 months, it was flying at the Aboriginal embassy. Within a year, it was nationally accepted around Australia by the people as their symbol.
So is the flag then simply token symbolism for the government in Canberra?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that the federal government began to incorporate the flag into their governmental logos, to me, represented the end of the real meaning of the Aboriginal flag.
Gary Foley is an Aboriginal Gumbanjer activist, writer, academic and actor. He's been speaking with us from Melbourne. Gary, great to meet you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. And hello to all my American friends.
Every day, our show brings you not just the important stories impacting our world, but also the human faces behind those stories. Take, for instance, the ongoing war in Yemen and the young woman trying to connect with her brother after days of an internet blackout there. Or the long journey of an Afghan family with three children to their new home in the United States. If you've missed any of these personal stories from our live show, you can still read about them and see the photos on our website, theworld.org. Across Africa, economies are struggling under the weight of the pandemic. In the West African nation of Ghana, the level of debt to foreign investors is rising quickly. To help pay back those investors, the Ghanaian government has proposed a tax on mobile money transactions. People transfer money with their cell phones. That's common in Ghana. It's how modern life works there. As Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports from the capital, Accra, many Ghanaians are outraged over the tax.
In a suburb of Accra, in a yellow shop covered with telecommunication flyers, Salome Ayete attends to customers. They are here to deposit or withdraw cash using their mobile money account, which are run by those same cell network providers. Ayete has been a mobile money vendor for 11 years. It's her only source of livelihood. She says the proposed tax on mobile money transactions could threaten that.
The business will collapse and it will affect us.
Mobile money is a digital payment platform that allows for the transfer of money between cell phones without being connected to the formal banking system. The technology was pioneered in 2007 by Kenya's Safaricom with its M-Pesa platform. Mobile money transactions boomed globally in 2020, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. Since the 1.75% tax was proposed on both mobile money and electronic bank transfers, Ayete says some of her customers are threatening to go back to the cash system.
It will not help us because they are complaining that if they bring that, then they will not do mobile money again.
According to the World Bank, 2 billion unbanked adults, mostly in developing countries, face barriers to tasks as simple as receiving wages or sending money to family members. Their finances are unstable because they don't have a good way to save for the future or borrow in times of need. That's why many Ghanaians have begun to rely on their mobile money account. Mavis Mensah hopes the government reconsiders the e-levy.
Things are getting tougher and tougher every day. To increase that is too much, so we are pleading with the government. If they can do something about it, it will be very nice, because it's too much.
Andreas Akakpo is skeptical of government spending.
When you collect a tax and you don't make good use of it, I don't see why the tax should be collected. Go to the interland. People are suffering.
The matter of the e-levy has sharply divided Ghana's hung legislature, leading to fisticuffs and massive boxing bout in parliament last month. Some MPs even had their outfits torn apart. Finance Minister Ken Ofori-Atta argues the e-levy would raise an additional 6.9 billion Ghanaian cedis, just about $1.15 billion in 2022.
E-levy will not only ensure that we move towards a more sustainable debt level, but will also ensure that we have the revenues to sustainably invest in entrepreneurship, youth employment, cybersecurity, digital and road infrastructure.
But according to the Foresight Africa 2019 report, excessive taxation on mobile phone-based transactions could potentially reverse the gains for financial inclusion. Ken Ashigbe is Chief Executive Officer of the Ghana Chamber of Telecommunications.
What has happened in other countries is that when these things have happened, you found out that people have gone back to cash, and then government has not been able to raise the revenue, and then jobs have been lost, and when even they've gone back and reduced it, the uptake has not gone back to what it was before then.
Ashigbe says a lower tax rate of 0.25 or 0.5 might have been better. At the mobile money outlet, Salome Ayete agrees. She believes a downward adjustment of the tax will help prevent her business from collapsing. Meanwhile, a vote on the levy resumes this week, and if passed, the taxes could go into effect next month. For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
One of the top allies to Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, has died in a hospital in Richmond, Virginia. Olavo de Carvalho was a self-described philosopher, former astrologer, and arguably the Brazilian most responsible for the resurgence of the far right in his country. Carvalho was also an outspoken COVID denier, One of his family has reported that Carvalho died of COVID. Journalist Michael Fox covers Brazil. Michael, sketch out for us who Olavo de Carvalho was and his connection to Bolsonaro and the far-right movement in Brazil.
Yeah, like you said, he's a self-described philosopher, traditionalist, former astrologer, who really became kind of an ideologue for the Brazilian far right over the last 20 years. A lot of people call him Bolsonaro's philosophical guru. And a lot of ways, he really laid the field for Bolsonaro's election. Several of Bolsonaro's ministers were Olavetes or Olavo de Carvalho followers. And in fact, on the day of Bolsonaro's acceptance speech, he had on his table next to the Constitution and the Bible Olavo de Carvalho's most famous book, The Minimum You Need to Know to Not Be an Idiot.
So apparently a big influence on current politics in Brazil. What was Carvalho doing in the United States, and how was he able to influence politics from so far away?
Well, he moved to the U.S. in the mid-2000s. At the time, he said he was doing journalism. He also has said that he was fleeing the quote-unquote dictatorship of the Workers' Party. This was just a couple years after former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva had come to power. And in the U.S., from Richmond, Virginia, he set up these online philosophy courses where he just taught thousands in his revisionist theories and history. This really called a lot of people to him.
What were his most influential ideas? Like, how did he make an impact?
Well, let me give you an example.
Por que o americano loiro tem vergonha de ser branco?
So in this clip, he's saying, why is a blonde American embarrassed to be white? Well, because there's a 200-year-old campaign of lies qualifying the white race as the great slave master of the planet. These revisionist theories that he had that he really pushed forward. One of them is this. The other one, he said that Nazism and fascism were actually left wing. He said that 99% of Brazil's parties were communists, and that there was this kind of communist left-wing cabal to take over the world and take over Brazil. So he would kind of take these theories using these kind of obscure books and things to kind of flip what we understand and what we know on their heads.
And Brazilians were swayed by Carvalho's ideas.
Oh, completely. In fact, even as of 2013, there were these big marches happening in Brazil, and many people were in the streets with these signs saying Olavo was right. Now, remember, that was just 5 years before Bolsonaro's election.
Who pushes back against his ideas in Brazil? I mean, how do they go over with Afro-Brazilians?
Well, obviously, many, many people push back on the left, and we've seen kind of this outpouring over social media. Of course, Afro-Brazilians don't, by and large, don't support him, but many, many do. He has this way of kind of using these ideas to get underneath the skin. He would say, people, look, if you're in a debate, it's not about winning the debate. The other people are just wrong, and they're going to say that you're crazy, but you just have to know that they're crazy. So he had kind of this self-defense mechanism built into his philosophy that helped his supporters to just deny anything else.
Michael, how are people in Brazil taking the news of Carvalho's death?
Well, of course, there's been an outpouring over social media from both his opponents and his supporters. Many people have pointed out the fact that he was a COVID denier and most likely died of COVID. He tested positive just over a week before he died. Bolsonaro has called him a beacon for millions of Brazilians. The Brazilian flag has been flying at half-mast, and Bolsonaro called for a day of mourning. And I think what's really important to remember is that his legacy, regardless of his death, is going to continue for a very long time. He taught thousands of people, and there's just thousands of hours and dozens of books of his. So he's going to continue to influence Brazilian society and politics for a very long time.
Journalist Michael Fox telling us about Brazilian political thinker Olavo de Carvalho, who died Monday in Richmond, Virginia. He was 74. Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you.
After more than three decades, the relationship between Thailand and Saudi Arabia is on the mend. Top officials met today in Riyadh and decided to let bygones be bygones. Why, you ask, were they angry at each other in the first place? Well, that's a story that involves a Thai gardener, a Saudi prince, murders, and a jewel heist. Here's the world's Sarah Birnbaum.
The story starts in 1989 with a Thai man named Krongkrai Chechamong. He goes to Saudi Arabia to look for work and lands a job as a gardener in the palace of the Saudi prince. Now, the prince has a collection of jewels which would make Elizabeth Taylor very jealous. We're talking rubies the size of chicken eggs and one of the largest blue diamonds in the world. The Saudi prince kept the jewels in a safe in his bedroom. Not the greatest idea, but okay. So Krongkrai decides, I'm going to take these jewels. Now, at this point, if this were a movie, you'd have some complicated plan a la Ocean's 11.
First task, reconnaissance. I want to know everything that's going on in all three.
But Cronkry is no professional jewel thief. So, one night, when the prince is away, he climbs into the palace through a second-story window, busts open the safe with a screwdriver, grabs some 200 pounds worth of jewels, stuffs them into a vacuum cleaner bag, and waltzes out of the palace. Then he mails the loot back to Thailand.
Getting it to the right place at the right time. DHL.
Yeah, via DHL. Then Cronkry flies back to Thailand. So the prince comes home and notices that the jewels are missing. And it doesn't take a genius to put two and two together and realize that Cronkry is the guy who did it. So they get the Thai police to arrest Cronkry, but it's too late. He already sold the jewels to a local dealer. But no biggie. The police go to the jewelry dealer, they arrest him, and they take the stolen jewels back to Saudi Arabia. Or not so fast. Turns out the jewels were fakes. And coincidentally, there were rumors that wives of Thai officials were wearing their real jewels out on the town. This was too much for Saudi Arabia. They sent diplomats to Thailand to investigate. And within a month, three of them are murdered and one goes missing. No one knows for sure whether these murders were linked to the Blue Diamond affair, but Saudi cuts off trade and recalls their ambassador. And finally today, 33 years later, the rift was repaired. But, you say, what happened to Cronkry? Well, he served a 3-year prison sentence, and then he became a monk. In 2019, he told the BBC that he felt terrible about the killings and that he became a monk to beg for forgiveness from everyone ensnared by his karma. And the name he chose for himself when he became a monk, it translates to he who is as strong as a diamond. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Wow. And now you know. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll be back with you tomorrow.